as we all know, this church has more images of the Virgin Mary, who think they celebrate today, than I think any other Episcopal church in New York, including the Mary of the Virgin Final Prayer. That's a bit of southern baptism and started out. But as some of you know, there are theological and historic reasons for this in regard to this church. The first Father Houghton was a follower of the early Oxford movement in England, the Eastern revival of the more passive aspect of Anglicanism, and he was well aware that at the time of the Reformation there had been a reaction against the honouring of Mary in the church, which would rather be not removed, but sidelined. And he was keen to bring that into mainline Episcopal tradition, a proper faith for Mary. And he, among the first artworks in the church, was a wonderful mosaic by the side of the Santa Cruz, the Annunciation. You might think, well, every church has an Annunciation, well, every church did not have an Annunciation in the mid-19th century. And he was also responsible for the statue of Our Lady in the Holy Family Chapel, and those two large pictures, the Raphael and the Murillo copies. And so he was also a reader, I think, Pergadami, who knows from the days of his time. It was the second Father Houghton, whose wife tragically died after thinking about 2 years, and her name happened to be Mary. And in those before group fasting, something like memorializing your wife once a week for the next 20 years. Well, it's normal feedback. And so we have the Mary Chapel, not so like a memorial ground church, in memory of Mary Carton, and more often than not, they show some aspects of the life of the Blessed Virgin. And if you are interested in following this up, the glass screen on the Mary Chapel, of the Holy Family Chapel, is an absolute gem. It has, I think, 12 famous copies of 12 famous artwork paintings of the Blessed Virgin Mary in glass, and it's worth sort of looking at them closely. But from time to time, you see things in a new light. And it's a thing that I've been talking about to you, the new light in the sanctuary. For one thing, you see the figures at the top of the real rock over the high altar. And there are rather gloomy before. And right at the top, you see there, above the bas-relief of the Transfiguration, you see the two crucifix on the other side, Mary and John. This grouping is often called a rood cross, R-O-O-D cross. And rood is simply a Saxon word for cross, but the reference to the rood cross is it stood at the council out over a screen or a beam called rooding, rood screen, and in the medieval church. And typically, in also in some European churches, you can see things in the church. And the women have not been restored in the 19th century, often restored in more Anglo-Saxon churches. So if you have these, not rooms of screens, it's sort of a low screen, but the room is placed right up top on the altar. There's another one on the screen in the chapel. And the grouping, of course, refers to St. John's Gospel. And that image of St. John's cross and standing at the cross of Mary and the other women and John. And many John's crosses, Jesus reaches out to both of them and says to Mary, the holding son. And to this point, John, he says, son, hold your mother. It's a very poignant moment in the crucifixion. And I like to think of Mary standing there, watching and waiting and weeping, standing with Jesus in the power of meaning. Last Sunday I talked about the pandemic and we've got all the storms that we're facing at present. And I like to think about in regard to Mary stands with us in our suffering and our need and our anger. As she stood with Jesus in his suffering on the cross. She stands with us and she stood with him with such deep, sympathetic love and compassion. But today, I want particularly to think of the Blessed Virgin Mary in relation to the other major issue we are facing in this country, American society, but also in consequence, countries like England, Europe, and indeed to Australia as well. We're all familiar with the Black Lives Matter movement, which grew out of the city of Martyrdom and Ferguson, Missouri, in 2014, and has been revived several times, and then this year with the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis on Memorial Day. And the size and the intensity and the constancy, as well as the diversity of the participants of the related protest movement, is familiar to us all. Of course, at the heart of the current crisis is the issue of racism in our community. We've heard a lot about the issue of police and racism, but that's only one aspect of the current crisis, because the commentators rightly note that the debate needs to focus more widely, certainly on police, but also on issues of education, health, and poverty as well. And I'm taking the opportunity of the ongoing debate, and also having the time in my hand, to really start the subject of racism, not only as American citizens, but as a series of American citizens, but also in relation to my Australian citizenship, because the issues of racism are prevalent there as well as in countries with significant racial minorities and diverse cultures. If I was accused of being a racist, or almost accused of being racist, I think all of us would probably recall in horror and say, not I. But the more I read about the issue, I'm more convinced in error of what is called systemic racism. Racism that is built into the very system by which we live and results in those inevitable outcomes in such areas as health, housing, education, and employment. And likewise, at first in my reading, I found phrases like white privilege and white supremacy rather unsettling. I've been reading the Hugh Morris's book, Hugh Morris, by the way, if you don't know it, a leading liberal evangelical spokesperson in America, a very impressive man. Not all evangelicals are right-wing, but important to note that to the left-wing as well. But Hugh Morris has put America's original sin, referring of course to slavery, helped me to see that many of us need to identify and to recognize our white privilege. And also, if you like to note, for those of us who have been appropriate, our moral privilege, while at the same time recognizing that responsibility needs to accompany that privilege. He says, white responsibility goes with white privilege. I think it's a very helpful way of looking at the issue of privilege. You can't do away with it. We are who we are. We went to school, we went to the parents, we went to school, raise. We can't sort of still manage that. That's part of our mental. But we can recognize it. This is a new mental thing to do that. People are recognizing, we need to understand the issue of the responsibility And long ago, in my recent reading, it's only the history of this society, and in my own case, Australian society as well, what I call losing history, warts and all. The more I've been doing part of Australian history in this year, it's not quite hard, because there's a lot of Australian history at school. But I'm trying to say that the history that I learned as an Australian child, and to state my view, that history almost entirely airbrushed out the existence of, let alone the injustice, the violence and ignorant policies inflicted on the Aboriginal inhabitants of Australia. The history I learned was only Captain Cook in 1776. But there was 40,000 years of civilized history before that. But even this one, it isn't even longer. Some of you remember, you may have been crazy about the Charles and Convention, I think it was 2 years ago, when the rector of James Hyde Park, of the Hudson, he and his prisoners put on a drama, a convention, and it's based on the history of that parish and on some of the issues about racism in 19th century America. And while they put it on was the fact they fell, of course, the very high part was built by slaves and largely funded by slaves only. And the council, as a way of coming to terms with that history, they were put on this drama. It is very powerful, and it seems to be performed at St. Thomas's in Fitzgerald. But what fascinated me about the whole issue was how ignorant the American audience, which is the member of the convention and the first, how ignorant the American audience was in the issue of slavery in New York. Now, some of you may have gone to the exhibition of the Historical Society in 2006 or 2007, which was called Slavery in New York. And I found that absolutely revelatory, that I'd never thought about it. I was a slave in the Southern world. And I think many, many people in this part of the world think that has something to do with the South, and also to do with the Civil War. But New York was built on slavery, and there are many slave owners in this city. And that's part of the reality. And so I found it very helpful to see the drama, at least coming to terms with something in the history of our part of the world. The diocese is really trying to take to come to terms with that and come to remember the last convention, the bishop, and this one now, reparation from the diocese of New York. Setting aside some of money for, I don't think they were that powerful to use, but to sort of some acknowledgement that slavery was part of the war, if you like, of the history of church in this part of the world. We might be asking, it's all very well, and this is St. John has been. And we talk of here, sounding up a bit about my own reaction to the issue of racism, you might say, what does the Virgin Mary have to do with all this? Well, I mean, here's another reason as well. I came across a very interesting article recently about Black Madonna. And most of you probably know that it is Black Madonna, a very famous one, the one in Poland, Montserrat and Spain and Loretta and Italy and France and France. But this article is saying that actually in Europe alone there are 450 medieval Black Madonnas. 450. We're so used to the Madonna being white. All of them in the church are white with the snow. I mean, they're beautiful. They're on top of women, studying equally until and the composition of sexual equality. He is teaching these creeds compared to the whole world. But there was this powerful Byzantine and medieval tradition that the Virgin is dark skin, brown or black, of course, we don't know how to get it. But it certainly made me think how we are so called schooled in our art, our history, and our food is body. Think about it. We're very old. Rotten, deep, old, or rotten. Think about these black and brown. There's another tradition, a bull, that married many novels of Raja, whoever I see. We can't distinctly type her, but what is more likely to be is a Middle Eastern woman, a woman of some sort of political period. I told you some of you have heard my story before. My nephew married an Israeli scholar of Tunisian origin. And 25 years ago, my sister and I went to the Holy Land, and the carpenter said, my great nephew's bar mitzvah. My great nephew's name is Friar. And Barlow had a bar mitzvah, and the party was at Nick Morris, just north of Tel Aviv, on the Mediterranean, the other part of the world. My sisters and I attended a lovely party in the garden of this church. And it was a lovely party, lots of dancing and lots of movement and those that part of the world. But the funny thing was, soon after we arrived, my sister-in-law came rushing to me and said that somebody dared to ask me, who are the three black people? And it really took home. We were the strangers, we were the outsiders, in the land of the Bible. And it really reminded me that Jesus and Mary and the whole lot of them were people of what we call gaudy or brown or dark appearance compared to ourselves, if we happen to be black. But it's very interesting. It was one of those moments of life, a sort of aha moment, that I am different from the majority of people in this place. So some of you may have learned that experience more painfully in other places. So what I like to think about Mary, whatever she looked like, this is probably not a widely seen woman. She is a woman for all kingdoms and for all people. But one last word, if you think I've said this too far and unpolished, in some inappropriate way, I don't mean in public event here in this church, but in more churches than home. I want to direct you to today's gospel, to the Magnificat. If you really read it and reread it, it is a radical call to action by a woman who stood in the great Hebrew prophetic tradition in the long line of Old Testament women, beginning with Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Miriam and Deborah and Hannah. Women who were faithful and fasting and dedicated to God. Men who did not grace and noble people. So thanks be to God for the Blessed Virgin Mary, the mother of God's incarnate Son, the first disciple of Jesus, and indeed the mother of the Church, and our companion in our journey of love and prayer. And encouragement of our civil ministry of peace and justice and compassion. Amen.